It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Wash your hands.
Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. How are you? Hope it's fine where you are. If you want to contact the programme, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Have a little listen to this. Sort of calming, isn't it? It's calming. The reason I'm playing that is because we got an email in from Marion Bradley. And Marion's from Ballyhugh, Ballyconnell in County Cavan. And she says, with a glad heart, I've once again heard the seasonal courting call of the cuckoo this evening, the 21st of April, in Big Eddie's Long Field. I love that. Big Eddie's Long Field beside our home here in Ballyhugh, West Cavan, next door to the townland of Clintycoo, or Meadow of the Cuckoo, which heralds the end of a particularly long, hard pandemic winter and the arrival of spring. This haunting voice is the source of many myths, Marion says. I turned towards the west and faced the most beautiful setting sun, made a wish while turning three times. According to folklore tradition, it's supposed to come true. Aha. Since ancient times, the call of the cuckoo is supposed to have different meanings. If unmarried, then the number of calls indicate the number of years you will remain single. If you are married, the calls indicate when next child arrives. And if you're elderly, it will indicate how many years you have left. If you have any coins in your pocket, remove and spit on them. And you'll never see a poor day again in your life. To hear your first cuckoo before breakfast is just unlucky. But if you're still in bed, it's a sure sign of impending illness. That's the incentive to get up out of bed and rise early. However, good fortune will come if you hear one while out walking. And a child born on the day of the first cuckoo in spring will be lucky for all of its life. Thanks so much, Marion. Aww. There's Marion there from Ballyhugh, West Cavan, next door to the townland of Clintycoo, or Meadow of the Cuckoo. And she was out walking and she heard the cuckoo in Big Eddie's Long Field. You just have to love that. Noel was on to ray@rte.ie. He says, I love the meatloaf memories yesterday. They brought back a mad memory to me. Years ago on the telly, I saw a show about a man and his watercress. Where's this going, Noel? This man had two greenhouses where he was growing watercress. Here's the mad part, Ray. In one greenhouse, he played classical music through a speaker to the watercress. In the other greenhouse, he played Bad Out of Hell by Meatloaf to the watercress. If my memory is right, the watercress that was played classical music grew normally. But my God, the watercress that was played Bad Out of Hell went crazy. It feckin' doubled in size. Exponential growth, as they say. Was it real? Does Bad Out of Hell make stuff grow faster? Ask Noel. So one in one greenhouse he was going. And then the other greenhouse with his watercress he was going. He probably wasn't playing. That'd probably make the watercress grow. He was probably playing. And you can see how the watercress would go, ah, no. Not for growing today. Just going to hang around here and enjoy this. Noel, to be honest, I think he dreamt it. Why let the truth stand in the way of a good story? Although, coincidentally, my daughter did a science experiment last year with coriander, where she played music to one plant and she didn't play music to another plant. And as it happens, the coriander plant that was played music grew faster than the other one. Can't remember what she played. Whether it wasn't Bad Out of Hell, it wasn't classical music, it was some sort of pop music. So you're onto something there. Maybe we'll try and recreate the experiment with the classical music and Bad Out of Hell and watercress, or maybe we won't. We'll see. Now, who's this? Doesn't give a name. I was chuckling away to myself when you asked if you dreamed going to a meatloaf gig down the country. Right after you said it, I had such a vivid flashback to one of the weirdest gigs I was ever at. Picture this. Oh, they're a great band. No, sorry. Picture this, yeah. It's 1998. Rockefeller Skank is about to burst onto the charts. Fatboy Slim is the DJ everyone wants to see. He was probably one of the first superstar DJs, wasn't he? Anyway, he's on the bill for the GPO nightclub on Eglinton Street in Galway. I don't know how we got tickets, but we managed to squeeze in to dance to a living legend. If you've ever been there, you know how small the place is. And that night it was wedged, as they say. There were very cool looking music journalists who had flown in from the UK. Everyone who got in couldn't believe their luck that we got to see him play in such an intimate venue. The lights go down, the music starts, the building vibrates with the dancing and the excitement. It was sweaty, it was sublime. It was simply stunning.
Right about now. The Funk Soul Brother, check it out now. The Funk Soul Brother, right about now.
And then Ray, half an hour into the biggest DJ in the world said, VOOM! The speakers are switched off, the lights go up, and from the far side of the room, I spot a couple of fluorescent jackets of the boys in blue marching in to make sure this nightclub law is being enforced. This was the one where the music had to be stopped while food was served. A couple of people dash upstairs for a chicken curry while Norman Cook, a.k.a. Fatboy Slim, looks on, totally bemused. I read afterwards in an interview he gave about it that it was one of the most surreal things he ever experienced and that if he ever wrote a book, that story will be in there. You and me both, Fatboy.
That's great.
What was it? Chicken curry. In the nightclubs I used to do, it was chicken, mashed potatoes and peas. And you had to say that, you know, then you had to say last call for alcohol because the bar was going to close. And supper's now being served. If you have your raffle ticket tonight on the menu, it's chicken, mashed potatoes and peas. Yeah, this isn't my first rodeo. Somebody said that to me last weekend. And then I heard it again. And then I was reading the Irish Times yesterday and Pat Leahy wrote it. Everyone knows the drill at this stage. This isn't anyone's first rodeo. And I was thinking to myself, where has that come from? Out of nowhere. And I get a bit prickly when I hear the word used by loads of people over and over again. I don't know why. So anyway, I said I'd look up the etymology. I'm all into etymology at the moment. The origins of the phrase. Where did they come from? Well, it's back to 1981 and a movie called Mummy Dearest, which was based on a book called Mummy Dearest, which was written by Christina Crawford, who was the adopted daughter of Joan Crawford. And for the purpose of the movie, Joan Crawford was played by Faye Dunaway. And she utters the line, this isn't my first time at the rodeo. And the reason being, the real life Joan Crawford, one of her husbands was CEO of Pepsi. He died in office, so to speak. And whatever the rules were, she inherited the position. But the all-male board wanted to give her the elbow. And she was having none of it. So in the scene you're about to hear, she's going, lads, I'm no walkover. This isn't my first rodeo. So this is Faye Dunaway playing the part of Joan Crawford.
Don't f*** with me, fellas! This ain't my first time at the rodeo.
Yeah, yes.
This ain't my first time at the rodeo. This ain't my first time at the rodeo.
Fatboy Slim got his hands on that. He could make something out of it. So that's where it comes from. And why it's back in vogue, I don't know. I put it into the search engine and the last time it was talked about was in 2015. So if anybody knows who started it this time round, do let me know. And I looked up the etymology of that other phrase that's been used a lot at the moment, an abundance of caution. I thought it was a scientific term. It's not a scientific term at all. It's to do with law. That's been used a lot as well, maybe overused. Jean has been on. It's great. RTE.ie, Ray at RTE.ie. Very busy on the email thing. Keep them coming. Jean has been on. She says, I've just been able to get a copy of the book, A Page for My Life. It's unputdownable. Just one more page, etc., etc. Are they doing another one this year? I have a story or two to contribute. Do I send them to RTE and when? Thanks a million, Jane. When you say they, it's us. We did it. And I don't know if we're going to do it again, to be honest. It was a huge success. We still don't know how much money we raised for Laura Lynn. When I say we, I mean the people who bought it. But it was just such a rewarding project to be involved in. 150 people made it into the final publication, but we got thousands of entries last year. So we may do it again. I was just thinking about the book actually last night because I'm doing a thing at the weekend. That's what they say in the business. I'm doing a thing at the weekend. I'm interviewing Marion Keyes for the Court Literary Festival. And it's a virtual thing, so people can watch online. Really looking forward to it. I've never interviewed Marianne Keyes before, but I'm fascinated by her. A big fan of her work. So I was going to bring her A Page from My Life. I think she might be interested. I think she might like it. It might give her some inspiration for future novels. So that's why I was thinking of A Page from My Life last night. And while we're speaking of Marianne Keyes, if you're a fan and you want me to ask her a question on Saturday night when I'm talking to her, get them into us and I'll put them to her if they're interesting enough. And finally, for the moment, from the email overnight, Sorka was on. She says, can we wish our son, Noah, a really happy 6th birthday today with all our love from Mum, Dad, brothers Jacob and Luca. And from Granny and Grandad, who will visit us today. This will be the first time the children have seen their grandparents since September last year. Do the maths on that. What's that? 7 months or thereabouts. There was a chilly half hour in the garden on Christmas Eve. But apart from that, we haven't seen them in that long. That's brilliant news. What a brilliant day for Noah. He'll remember his 6th birthday when Granny and Grandad came around for the first time in 7 months. So happy birthday, Noah. Have a good one. Now let's see what you're saying. Ray, what happens to you if you hear the cuckoo on the radio? Just ask them. Well, we'll have to build a tradition around that. If you walk 3 times backwards around the kitchen table and make a wish, it won't come true. There you go. My grandfather used to ask us, what was it a sign of if you heard the cuckoo? It was a sign that you weren't deaf, was the answer. That's Johnny Killarney. And also heard the cuckoo for the first time this morning. It made my day, says Margaret. And the music to play to a coriander plant is the scary bit from Carmina Burana, the Om music. To kill it, says Tom. He's obviously not a fan of coriander. I think it's a bit like Marmite, isn't it? Coriander, it splits people down the middle. It's quite perfumey. A lot of people don't like it. I'm a big fan of it. Ray, you were the first superstar DJ. oh no, I was not. Or anywhere near there. Now! Time for our quiz of today. Today being the 22nd of April, we've cobbled together 10 questions on events that happened on this day over the years. You know how it works, and we're looking for 2 people to come on and answer 5 questions each and maybe win a prize. Well, one person will definitely win a prize. And the prize comes from the Heritage, which is in Laois. It's set in the heart of the countryside in the pretty village of Killinard, just over an hour's drive from Dublin, and you can enjoy on-site activities like golf, tennis, country walks, or visit the leisure centre or the award-winning spa. So the prize is a luxurious 2-night break in the Heritage. You can find out more at theheritage.com. So if you want to be involved, here's our qualifying question. In which Irish county would you find the town of Cove? In which Irish county would you find the town of Cove? 1850 715 900. 1850 715 900. We're looking for 2 people to come on and answer questions on events that happened on this day over the years and maybe win a prize. 1850 715 900. Good luck with that. And for other correspondence, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. Come on, Jack! Go on, Jack! That's Jack L. And that's the way he would have been shouted at from the sidelines when he played for a thigh back in the day. Perfect song, Georgie Boy. Jack L is the king. And great to hear Jack Lukeman, a good Kildare man. Fab voices, Miriam. Well, the good news, Miriam, is that we're having Jack on tomorrow, live. Now, there are restrictions at the moment, and we can't have people in studio, so we're trying this. It's a big experiment, a big technological experiment, and Jack L has agreed to be our guinea pig on it. So we're going to call them, and I'm probably hexing it now by just putting a name on it, the Kitchen Sessions, and we're going to try and get people, musicians, from all over the place to set up a little setup in their kitchen or wherever and sing live to us. And anyway, Jack L tomorrow on the show. Looking forward to that. Dr. Phil says, this isn't my first rodeo. Almost on every show, says Louise. And Ray, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, who you were talking about, never got on in life. They detested each other. So when Joan Crawford died, Betty Davis was asked, had she any comments to make when told the news? She said, I've always been brought up to speak good of the dead. So Joan is dead. Good. Oliver in Wexford. Very clever. Mean, but clever. I was just looking. Frank Yablans was the scriptwriter and producer of the movie Mommy Dearest. And Christina Crawford's book didn't have that exact quote in it. This isn't my first rodeo. He wrote it. Now, he probably heard it somewhere else. So I'm not saying that it was the original thought in his brain, but it may have been. Frank Yablans, scriptwriter. Now, remember you spinning the discs in a certain Carlo nightclub in the 80s? It was called Mimes, as it happens. You were there and the live band were downstairs. And yes, the raffle tickets got us chicken and chips. Those were the days in the late 80s. Melting here in the heat. Long may it last, says Martina. Yeah, Martina, I was just trying to remember that. Wasn't it all to do with the licensing laws? If you wanted the bar extension back in the day, you had to serve a supper. So reluctantly, nightclub owners and hotel owners set, you know, did the supper thing. And the DJs like myself used to have to say, supper's now been served. Make sure you have your raffle tickets. Tonight it's chicken and chips. And then you'd have to say, last call for alcohol and all that sort of thing. 51551 Ray at RTE.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, when I was off there at Easter, I read a great book by an Irish author. The book is called 10 Days. The author is Austin Duffy. And Austin is on the line now. How are you doing, Austin?
Oh, great, Ray. Thanks. And yourself?
Good, good. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. The great story, which we'll get to in a moment, you yourself have a great story because not only do you write books, but you're an oncologist.
That's right, yeah. I'm an oncologist. I work at the Mater and also UCD as well. And, you know, I've been doing that for a number of years. A lot of the time I spent in the United States, actually.
Okay.
I did all my training, medical training and so forth in Ireland and grew up in Dundalk. Did all my training here.
Can I bring you back to Dundalk for a minute? Because I'm interested in this. You know, because I have a hunch that in a lot of schools in Ireland, just because you could get enough points for medicine, that's why you did it. It wasn't because you particularly wanted to do it or that you, you know, had a burning ambition to be a doctor. It was because, you know, you were the brightest in the class or thereabouts and you could get the points, so you did medicine. Was that the story with you?
Yeah, I kind of think you're right. I sort of went into medicine like that. I mean, back then, I don't remember at that age thinking that there were a whole pile of other options
okay.
we could do. I mean, obviously the world is a different place now, but it seemed like a good idea. I mean, I couldn't think of a better alternative.
Had you an ambition to be a writer when you were at secondary school?
I wouldn't go that far. I had an amazing English teacher, absolutely amazing, a guy by the name of Sidney Peck. He was a Canadian fella, you know, and he came in midway through, I think it was our second year. And he was kind of an irreverent sort, you know. It very similar to the guy in Dead Poets Society, you know.
Robin Williams.
Very similar. Yeah. It's almost a cliche, but it's sort of true. And Sidney Peck, he came in. He was very funny, irreverent, and he just got us all energized in writing. And I got into it big time, you know. I just used to spend all weekend working on the school essays, you know. Before Sidney, it would have been totally boring, you know. And I just got into it. But I don't know if I can honestly say I wanted to be a writer. I probably didn't even know that that was a possibility, you know.
Yeah.
So I ended up going down a different path for a while.
So you studied medicine in Trinity College.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, as often happens, you qualify and you have to go outside of Ireland to get better qualifications. So
right.
Where did you ended up in New York?
Yeah, I ended up in New York. To cut a long story short, I ended up in New York in 2006. So this is after I did all my, you know, junior doctor training and oncology training, on the job training, really, in Ireland. And 2006, I was lucky, actually. I won a sort of a scholarship award to go to Memorial Sloan Kettering. It's a famous cancer hospital on the Upper East Side.
Right.
And so I find myself over there and I was living, they put me in this very basic accommodation. I was just so happy to be there. I would have stayed anywhere. And it was in a sort of a bed sit, what we call a bed sit, a studio apartment, very basic on the hospital grounds. I'd no television, I'd no internet. And I thought, I'd always had, like lots of people, I suppose, I always had this sort of hankering that, oh, you know, to get back into the writing and to do it seriously and all that, never came to anything. So I thought, here I found myself in New York, with no distractions, really, other than New York itself and the work. And I thought, well, if I'm ever going to do it, I might as well do it now. So I joined this, I came across this organization called the Writer's Studio down in Greenwich Village. And they were amazing. You know, I just got into it and it was just a one night a week job, but whatever exercises they said, I just took to it like a duck to water and really, really loved it and started doing it every day. And then the writing just became part of my life, you know. And it
when
was
you
a
say
number
you were writing every day, what were you writing? I know that sounds like a really stupid question, but
no, it's not actually. It's right on the money, because that's the thing about doing the writer's studio, and basically they're taught creative writing. So they would set up exercises, okay, and you would work on the exercises, and and then it's up to you, you know, you could just do the exercise and then forget about it. But I kind of got into it and started doing it every single day. And I think it was just the point of having this external, you know, contact where they would be setting you these sort of tasks, and you know, it just all sort of kicked in. Whereas if you're on your own trying to be a writer, as you said, it's very hard. What do you write about, and where do you start? And that was the bit I struggled.
But that was the worst thing at school, wasn't it? You know, write an essay about anything. No, tell me what to write an essay about, please. Please be prescriptive. Thank you very much. So it's parallel. You're advancing in the area of oncology, and you're developing as a writer. So how long did it take you to write your first book, This Living and Immortal Thing?
Yeah, it took. Oh my God, it must have took about 6 or 7 years. And you know, when I tell people that, they expect to see this big massive tome, you know, but it's actually not at all. It's like a small.
Again, I have to ask this. You know, so just talk me through how it takes 6 or 7 years.
Well, the first few years it was learning the craft of writing. I mean, it was total nonsense. The book itself was awful for so long, you know. I mean, it was all sorts of. I went down all sorts of rabbit holes and blind alleyways, and that was just, in hindsight, that was just me learning, you know, how to do it, you know. And I mean, most of that time, it was not worth reading in any shape or form. But gradually, it got a bit better. At one point, actually, what was a big inflection point was I won the Francis McManus
The short story award competition.
And that was big. Well, it was a shot in the arm, because at that stage I'd been writing for, you know, 4 or 5 years. And on my own, you know, with no one other than my wife knew I was writing, really. And this is this was a sort of a validation a little bit. And also, I have to say, as a result of that, I got contacted by an editor who was really then helpful and constructive, and reviewed the manuscript on several occasions. And he ultimately passed on it. He was absolutely instrumental to and pointed me in the right direction. Otherwise, I'd still be down one of those rabbit holes, to be honest with you.
You've been lucky with your teacher, with that amazing name. He sounds like he should be in a movie. And then the group in New York, and then this editor. And all of this time, you're developing as an oncologist, and you meet Naomi, your wife, in New York, is it?
That's right. Yeah. Naomi's from New York. She's grew up in the Bronx, Riverdale in the Bronx. And yeah, we met in a place called the Arch Students League. It's one of these great public institutions they have in New York, where you can go and pay not very much money to do painting. And she's an artist, Naomi, and we met there. And we sort of got together. And then my fellowship, it was a 2-year thing at Memorial that came to an end. And we just met, so I got offered a position down in Washington, D.C., working for what's called the National Cancer Institute, which is basically the U.S. federal government's research arm, you know. Okay. And so we went down there. It worked out on a personal level and also career-wise, and so we sort of moved down there. We got married, our kids were born, and we were very happy in Washington, actually. Ended up spending 9 years there. And it was just brilliant. Before I managed to talk Naomi into coming, and the kids into moving back to Ireland.
Oh, Dublin. The kids didn't have much choice now. What age were they, in fairness?
You'd be surprised. my son is 8 now, and my daughter is 5.
Okay, so 10 Days is the new book. You draw on your experience in New York, because New York is a character in the book, and I know that sounds a little bit up its own behind, but it is. It's you know, your knowledge of New York, obviously, it's, you know, it's there in every page or every second page, and Naomi's background, you borrow from that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so Naomi's Jewish, and so when we met, you know, that was obviously something that, you know, I was sort of experiencing it for the first time. I'd never really met, you know, growing up in Ireland and all, you don't, there are some Jewish people around for sure, but, and there used to be more back in the day, but I wasn't really familiar with that faith at all. And sort of meeting Naomi and all her family was the first introduction to that. Going to all the family events, the religious events. In the Jewish faith, there seems to be one every week. You know, it's great. And, you know, so that was all a big educational experience to me. Luckily, in a positive way, you know, it's never been a point of conflict, you know.
Yeah, because there is conflict in the book. So
yeah, well, there kind of has to be, yeah, you know. Yeah, I mean, yeah. If I wrote a novel where everybody was just grand, you know. And,
should try it, see how it goes.
Yeah, I have. It doesn't work out.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the happy ever after doesn't work out. There you go. So Wolf is the main character. His wife, Miriam, who's Jewish, has died. And Wolf and his daughter, Ruth, travelled to New York to spread her ashes on the Hudson River, and that's the basic. And the 10 days refers to the 10 days in New York. And there's a twist. You can say as much about it as you like. I don't want to give it away.
No, sure. I mean, yeah, you captured it very nicely there. Yeah, that's the premise of the book is this guy Wolf, whose wife has just died. And he's traveling to New York with her ashes to take part in a ceremony where he'll spread the ashes on the Hudson. Now, Miriam, who's died, was from the Jewish faith, and she was also from New York. So this is obviously where I was borrowing from Naomi's family and so forth. But the difference here, of course, is that in the Jewish faith, you know, cremation is very much frowned upon. It's not part of the Jewish tradition, really.
Why
it's
is that? I'm
not sure. I think it's something to do with having to maintain the integrity of the body,
right,
you know, for, you know, the return, for the coming of the Messiah or the Savior or whatever. But, you know, and that, so the body needs to be intact. I think that's the rationale for it.
Okay.
And but it's certainly not traditional, and that's a bone of contention with the family. Also, you know, the fact he isn't on good terms with his in-laws and the wider family. He hasn't seen them in 20 years. So there's bad blood there, bad feeling. And he's traveling over with, you know, ostensibly, you know, just for this short trip. The sort of, as the book moves on, it becomes apparent that there's this ulterior motive for the trip to do with his daughter. And basically he intends, you know, to transfer her care to the in-laws for reasons that sort of become clear as the book evolves. And of course, he keeps this a secret from the daughter and also from the family. And that is sort of explained as the sort of book progresses, because he's got a serious issue that he's kept to himself and he's trying to deal with, and ultimately he's going to need help with.
Yeah. You know, you write very well, because your children aren't that age yet, but I think you write very well describing the relationship and the scenes with Wolf and his daughter, because it's fractious and it's uneasy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're, both of them are grieving as well. So it's all very well written.
Oh, thank you.
10 days, Austin Duffy. Can I talk to you a little bit about oncology, the other side of your life?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So you're back and you're in The Matter and UCD, and you're practicing as well as researching. Is that it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm a medical oncologist, so basically I see folks with cancer, various stages of cancer, either, you know, they might have had an operation to try and cure the cancer and you're giving them treatment afterwards, or, you know, the other folks who have disease that's more advanced than that, and you're giving them drugs, either chemotherapy or other types of drugs to try and contain the cancer and treat it and basically look after and mind them and make sure they have all they need. And so that would be sort of the the sort of day-to-day kind of standard.
And it's an ever-evolving area of medicine, isn't it? And there are new drugs coming on the market every second month. The drug that people will know, I suppose, is pembrolizumab, because it's made famous by Vicky Phelan, and she'd prefer to be famous for other reasons, obviously. But so was that a revolutionary drug in its time, and has its position been overtaken?
Oh, so yeah, it's not just that drug itself, but yeah, the short answer would be yes, and almost to both questions. It was absolutely revolutionary and remains revolutionary. But basically what that drug is a type of what we call immunotherapy,
right,
which is basically where the short sort of explanation for that is an attempt to get patients' own immune systems to fight against their cancer. So traditionally we treat cancer, you know, with surgery, obviously, is probably the oldest, well, definitely the oldest type of anti-cancer treatment. People have been operating on tumours for thousands of years, and with some refinement, thankfully, over time. And then, of course, you had radiation treatment, which has been around, you know, for 100 years and, of course, has been refined and refined. Mm. And then chemotherapy is the other obvious traditional anti-cancer treatment. And they're the main types of anti-cancer treatment that still exist and we use all of the time. Immunotherapy is kind of a different concept, and it's basically, it's almost like where you're not even actually trying to treat the cancer directly. You're actually treating the person's immune system and trying to get their immune system interested in their cancer.
Okay.
And to get it to attack.
So it's like putting up a signpost directing the immune system towards the tumor.
So pretty much. And pembrolizumab is one of these drugs, and it's a major drug, and it's produced major benefits. You mentioned Vicky Phelan's case and it's really changed the game, and particularly in cancers such as melanoma or lung cancer, and, you know, cervical cancer, you know, other cancers, and it's absolutely terrific when it works, you know. The second part of your question was, well, you know,
has its position been overtaken?
Yeah, it's not so much that it's been overtaken. I mean, when it works, when the pembrolizumab or drugs like it, immune drugs, when they work, or if they work really, really well. The question is, how do we get them to work in other diseases or in those other patients in whom it's not working for whatever reason,
yes, yes,
or in whom it has stopped working? And that's kind of where the field is at the moment. And there's
Can I ask you a philosophical question about cancer treatment?
Sure.
If there is a person who has been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and if there is a drug that's at the early stages of development but hasn't been okayed by the EMA or whatever the FDA, whatever the equivalent is in America or whatever the equivalent is here, if that person is going to die anyway, should they not treat that person with that drug?
Yeah, well, so it depends. I probably wouldn't phrase it quite like that. In that, yeah, this is the second part of my job, really, which is to do that, is to provide that mechanism where patients can get access to drugs that might not have been approved yet, but which look exciting. The proper way to do that is to do it within the context where you have monitoring and proper informed consent. And that's basically, you know, the other part of my job, which is the academic sort of research part. And this is where, you know, what I'm very invested in doing is in opening what are called early phase clinical trials. And that's jargon, obviously, but that's basically what you're talking about, where you can actually provide access of drugs that you mentioned, drugs that look promising but that aren't approved by whoever, FDA, EMA or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they're not, because it takes 10, 15 years to get a drug to full market approval. So you're right, you know, what do we do? Just wait around for 10, 15 years for these drugs to become approved? No, that's not much help. So so absolutely, we need a mechanism to be able to treat or offer a drug that looks exciting you know, to patients in that situation.
Okay.
You have to do it properly, though. You can't just give.
No,
you know,
I know.
You can't just dole it out.
Of course,
it has to
be
monitored.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because you can cause a lot of damage with these drugs too. You know?
And the other thing is, which we've encountered loads of times on this program and other programs have as well, is the cost of these drugs.
Yeah.
Will you explain to us why they cost so much? And why governments around the world can't come together and pay for the research and development so that they own the drugs at the other end?
Yeah, so that's a really good and complicated question. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why the drugs are expensive. And, you know, part of it, you can sort of have a benign outlook on it and say, well, you know, it's to cover all the R&D costs that goes into this. And for sure, you know, from a pharmacist, I don't work for a pharmaceutical company or anything, so I'm not trying to defend any position or anything. But for sure, there's a huge amount of money that has to go into the R&D side. And then developing these drugs from, you know, basic laboratory experiments all the way through toxicology and animal studies and then through human studies to all the way through to the stage where you get a drug developed. It's hugely expensive, you know, and we only see of course the drugs that make it.
Yes.
We for every drug that makes it, there might be another 100 drugs which don't make it, which all go through the same expense. So all of that does feed into the cost and then the cost of manufacturing and all of that. But of course, yes, I mean, the pharmaceutical companies are also, you know, looking to make money and all of that. And you know, the best way for them to do that is to come up with a successful drug that works. In terms of, well, why don't governments do it themselves? It's just too expensive. Too costly. I mean, when I was in Washington, I worked for the NIH, the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. The American government doesn't make its own drugs.
Right,
I mean,
yeah.
There are certain situations where they do, you know, they do a lot of discovery. But even when they do that, they hand over the manufacturing to, you know, a third party with whatever agreement is in place. So there isn't really a government on the planet that could actually.
But if all governments, you know, I think it's like climate change and say taking on the big tech companies. It needs to be a global approach as opposed to, you know, individual countries. But anyway, that's another chat. What about charlatans preying on people who are dying of cancer?
Yeah, you know, I come across that every now and again, and it's absolutely heartbreaking, you know. You really do. I mean, the sort of stuff I'm doing in terms of trying to open these early phase trials and give access, it's hard work and it's difficult both for patients and people like me and, you know, to do it properly. It just is with the nature of it. You know, there are people, unfortunately, out there, you know, both internationally and here, who just don't bother with any of that, you know, and just hand out whatever and charge money for it. And yeah, I've seen great harm being done. Listen, I'm very open-minded. And if someone wants to try something and it's not harmful and I don't think it's going to interact or whatever, listen, I'll review any paper. I'll talk to somebody about whatever it is, because I'm fully aware and very humbly so on a daily basis of the limitations of modern medicine, you know, despite the fact that I do believe we're making progress. So, you know, listen, we all have to be able to look outside the box, but for sure there's harm that can be done. And there's places around the world which are trying to attract patients and making all sorts of promises. And what they're really doing is they're taking their money and they're stealing their time, you know. And I've seen that in action. It's not nice.
It's horrible.
It's horrible. Yeah.
Yes. Because people are at their most vulnerable and they're most exposed. And these people are preying on them. And it's just.
Right. Yeah.
It's very ugly. Very ugly. How do we call that out, I wonder? Anyway, that's another day's story as well. Austin Duffy, 10 Days is the book. A fascinating conversation about writing and about cancer. And I'm sure we'll chat again, and mind yourself. And congratulations again on the book. Thanks,
thank
Austin.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Should every day not be Earth Day? I think it probably should be. Eamon Ryan would agree with me on that one. On the line, we have Ray O'Neill, psychoanalyst. How are you doing, Ray?
Hello, Ray. How are you?
Good to talk to you. And Alison Keating, psychologist. How are you doing, Alison?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Ray and Alison are available to you for advice on relationship problems. Okay, so we'll get straight to it then. This is a friend relationship problem. My oldest friend is being mean to me, and I can only assume it's because I've finally turned my life around. For years, I've been the dumpy, insecure one, but with the help of my dynamic new sister-in-law and a new diet and more exercise, I'm now in better mental and physical shape than ever. Sadly, my friend isn't thrilled. She once joked that she had to be the pretty one, in inverted commas. Why can't she be happy for me? Alison.
Okay, so this is one, you know, I think we've all experienced and seen play out. And, you know, the kind of very thinly veiled, you know, ha ha ha, I have to be the pretty one, isn't actually funny, or nor is it actually a joke. So this person needs to ask themselves some question: are they actually being a friend? And were they being a friend when the other person had to feel better by being the supposedly pretty one?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah. Is there a bit of jealousy here as well?
Oh, absolutely.
The dynamic 100%. New sister-in-law.
Well, no, but I mean, she's beginning to feel better in herself. I mean, I do think that sometimes when people, you know, feel more comfortable in themselves, your identity can actually shift.
Ah, right.
And for other people, they can find that kind of disconcerting because they then feel less than. And, you know, it's like the dynamic in their friendship changes
from
the other person feeling like she's somewhat threatened. But it's kind of, I find it interesting that they needed to be the pretty one, but it's not very pretty behaviour.
No,
you know?
No. Ray?
Yeah, it's not very pretty behaviour, as Alison says, and bless but misery likes company. And so I don't think this friend is not only not happy for you, but I don't think she's happy in herself. And I think, Ray, you're right. I think she's jealous about this dynamic new sister-in-law who's energised. There's a reason why, say, for example, when someone is a recovering alcoholic and they've moved on with their life, they have to move on with their social life and their personal life as well. Mm. And it's amazing how many people have been part of the process of holding you back.
Well, in fairness, I suppose, and I've read this from people who are recovered alcoholics, that they surrounded themselves with people who facilitated their drinking.
Mm-hmm. And it would be the same with drugs as well.
Yes, yeah. So they have to shed those people to be well, I suppose. Mm. So what's our advice to this person then, Alison?
Well, I just like stand back and as you see, sometimes when we lose kind of literally the weight, there can be other kind of emotional baggage that we kind of go, do you know what? Has this person been a good friend to me even in the past? Do I come away from them after, you know, feeling energized and happy and kind of good, or do I feel drained, depleted and less than? So in terms of kind of the valuing where the relationship is at, I just think it's a good question to ask if you feel it's actually not doing you any good.
All right. And Ray?
And what I would say is, look, you've obviously taken great moves. Keep looking forward. Don't look back.
Okay.
The future's ahead of you.
Yeah. It sounds mostly positive there. Now, our next one, dear Ray and Alison, I'm very worried about my wife's weight. She is obese and we haven't made love in 2 years, but she refuses to diet. I keep warning her about heart disease and diabetes, but she bats me away. Cooking is her passion and that's fine, but how can I make her understand how worried I am about her long-term well-being? Ray.
Look, I think that's, again, a really hard one to approach, because how do you say that without the other person feeling judged or feeling criticised and potentially literally feeding their obsessions or passions in an unhealthy way? You just have to sit down with them and just say, look, we're together a long time and I want to be with you a long time. And here's my fear. And maybe it's just my fear. Maybe it's my stuff. But can we talk about it and see where that conversation might bring you? Mm. But you can't preach at somebody or you'll alienate them.
Alison?
Yeah, I agree. And I just... I really would always challenge kind of the idea you can't put someone else on a diet. Do you know that that's, you know, changing your kind of way that you eat is something that's going to have to actually come intrinsically. But I do think, like Ray's saying, you can sit down and lay out that this is kind of two pronged. One, it's that they're genuinely worried about their health, but two, they actually miss them. They miss the intimacy. And sometimes, you know, like this person, their passion is their food. I mean, perhaps the person and their cooking, you know, the husband might feel a little bit left out. But I've often found over the years that people, when that comfort eating is there, that they feel so bad in themselves that, as you said, any hint of criticism or judgment is going to be taken, you know, very, very personally. I just think we have to challenge the whole diet mentality anyway. And, you know, we don't really understand, going back to that sense of intuitive eating, that you actually, you know, you eat and then you stop when you're full, and you kind of, you genuinely understand that eating is such a psychologically complex experience. It's just not as easy as reducing the food down and going on the exercise. Like smoking is so much easier because you just stop, but you need to keep eating.
Yes.
So it's just to actually bring compassion to this. That's what I would actually say. That's how about going in with saying, look, I accept that this is the situation as it is. I am really worried about your health, you know, in terms of saying that I feel that there are concerns with diabetes or different things. And I also really miss you. So you're saying you accept them as you are, but you're worried about them and you want things to change. I think compassion is the key, to be quite honest. That's the way to actually change it.
It's a difficult chat to have.
It's a difficult one, but most chats are that are important.
Yes,
to be honest.
Yeah. Fair enough. Okay, I really hope that works out. Now, this is sort of the opposite, really, in a way. I used to laugh and tease my boyfriend when he boasted about his good looks and great body. I'd put up with the hours he spent in the bathroom because I was proud to be seen with such a handsome man. But 3 years on, his vanity is really beginning to get me down. He's not joking when he says that he's gorgeous and that I'm lucky to have him. I find this self-obsession very immature and I'm starting to find it unattractive. How can I get him to change? Oh, Ray, how can I get him to change?
Again, if only people would change when we asked them to.
If only it was that easy.
World would be, and relationships would be more successful. I think the key thing is what this person says when they say that I'm starting to find it unattractive. Because this is a person who's absolutely located in the body and in a vanity around his appearance. And it would be quite a shock to his ego and hopefully to his heart to actually kind of go, this isn't sexy. This isn't beautiful. And for her to actually not, or him or her, I'm not sure, to actually say that and to hold that position, I'm starting to not fancy you. I don't desire you. There's not room in the bedroom for me because your ego is all over the place.
Yeah. It's not attractive, is it, Alison?
It's really not attractive, but it's not an easy one to get someone to actually see that because they're so busy kind of in that gazing at their own reflection that they and it's kind of sad because there can be a lack of intimacy then because this person's kind of in love with themselves, do you know, but I mean that in a genuine way.
No, I know. I shouldn't laugh. I know.
He's kind of saying to her, you know, you're really lucky to be with a gorgeous guy like me, which actually that is really unattractive. Yeah. Like you're basically saying I'm better than you. And like the French one at the beginning, I don't think that's healthy. No. I don't think it's nice. And sometimes we have to bring it back to the basics of, do I actually like this person's character? You know, it's kind of a bit of a crass thing to say. You're really lucky to be with me.
it sounds like a deal breaker to me, you know. Like,
I think so too.
Yeah. Dre?
It is. The one thing I would just say in there is behind all those ego performances, let's never forget someone like Donald Trump, there is an incredible insecurity.
Yes. A fragility, yes.
And I don't know if this... That's why this is being so performed and being performed in this way. Now, if you can access that fragility, that's where true intimacy can happen. But otherwise, you know, you're only literally touching what he deems a very attractive surface, but it's still superficial.
Okay. Right. Thanks very much, Ray. Thanks, Alison. Mind yourselves.
Thanks a million.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 or ray@rte.ie. On Austin Duffy, who we spoke to before 4 o'clock. What an inspiration Austin Duffy is, very down to earth and genuine. And Gráinne says, you've just interviewed a very interesting oncologist, and apart from the very interesting chat on cancer and treatments, I didn't hear the title of the book. 10 Days is the name of Austin's new book, Gráinne. And somebody else says, what a breath of fresh air to hear Austin chat with you. He hasn't lost his roots, which is evident now and then when the flat, broad Dundalk accent comes through. I remember him calling to our house in town as he and my brother Thomas McAvoy attended CBS together and were good buddies. Austin sounds the same warm, genuine, friendly chap he was way back then. I've read his first book and can't wait to get into book number two. Great to hear he's back home again. Best wishes for the future to him and his family. And there's no name. Is there a name at the end of that? Let's just see. Is there a name at the end of that? No, there isn't. And on me DJing around the country, remember Nijinsky's, Ray? I do. Myself and my friends from St. Mary's Convent in Naas went there all the time. It was a nightclub on the edge of the Curra, for people who don't know. The teenage disco and then the over 18s, if you could get in. The teenage one was the best. The 80s, such innocent times, and yeah, they serve food there as well, says T and Nason. Martin Christie, or even Martin Christie, was on. He says, I so remember you announcing that supper is now being served in Nijinsky's nightclub, the Curra, and a mad queue for the kitchen. Bring back the 80s. Yeah, you'd go to a slow set when you announced the supper, you know, because you didn't want to announce the supper and be in the middle of a, you know, a rock set or a disco set, because then the floor would clear. So you go, and now we go for a slow set, and while I have you, the supper is now being served. Don't forget to bring your raffle tickets. It's chicken and mashed potatoes and peas, everybody. Yeah. It's time for our quiz of today. Today being the 22nd of April. Our prize today comes from the Heritage, luxurious two-night break in the Heritage, which is set in the heart of the countryside in the pretty village of Killinard in County Leash. Loads of things to do. Golf, tennis, country walks, leisure centre, spa, the whole lot. You can find out more at theheritage.com. Larry Burns is in Bishopstown in County Cork. How are you doing, Larry?
Hi, Ray. How are you?
I'm good. You're having a good day.
I'm having a great day. Out in the garden, enjoying the sunshine.
Great. Are you just sitting there or doing something?
I'm digging the thing up. I'm digging a big hole to try and...
And is there any plan, or are you just digging?
The plan keeps changing. That's the problem. The further into it I get. So we'll get there eventually. It's working hard.
No, was it a pond? Is it a feature? What are you doing?
They have the pond done. It's the grass is the problem, or lack thereof. Right. So trying to sort out that. This is done. This is the last
okay.
piece.
I mean, you say they. Who are they?
My parents. Yeah. Well, just trying to give them a hand, you know.
Right. And you've time on your hands to give them a hand.
Far too much, unfortunately, at the moment, yeah.
What do you do normally?
I'm a pilot, normally.
Okay.
When the world is normal again.
How many times have you flown a plane in the last year?
In the last year, in total, this year I've only flown once.
Once.
I've been in the simulator a few times, but just one flight. And I'd say in the last 12 months, I've done less than 10 flights in total.
As opposed to what would it be normally?
About 20 a week.
20 a week? So you
anywhere between 10 and 20 a week, yeah.
So you've done the equivalent of 3.5 days flying in a whole year?
In a whole year, yeah. Yeah.
Is the simulator, is that important to keep your skills up?
Yeah, well, we normally go into it every 6 months just to do training and checking and so on, but we now use it to practice takeoff and landing. So we have to do a certain amount of them every 90 days.
Yeah.
And we're not doing enough, unfortunately, so we're spending a lot of time in there.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different chatter coming from the people in charge, isn't there, as to whether we'll be flying out of the country this year to sun holidays?
Yeah, I think there are kind of some mixed messages, all right, but hopefully the rhetoric is changing more positive in that regard, you know, with the vaccines rolling out and... Yeah. Hopefully it will come right for us.
How have you been? That's a sort of a deep question, but you've minded yourself. Has it been okay for you?
It's kind of strange when you're going from a million miles an hour and to being tired and jet lagged and busy to stopping all of a sudden. So it took a while, but you know, getting used to it now as well.
And Larry, here's the deep 2021 question: Have you learned anything about yourself?
I have.
Great.
I've learned that I like gardening a lot.
Oh, no, there you
and it's loads being outdoors, yeah. Total change of scenery.
And there's something rewarding, even, you know, just digging a hole. It's like there's something, I think we're meant to dig holes. humans.
I think so.
I'm going to set up digging hole therapy along with IKEA therapy. That's my new career.
With the weather changing, it's just nice, you know.
It's nice, yeah. Let's see what the weather's like in Newport and County Tipperary. How are you doing, Lorraine?
Hello, Ray.
Lorraine Whelan. Where is Newport close to?
Newport is on the border with Limerick City, so we're just 10 miles out of the city, and then we'd be closest to Neenah, would be our biggest town. Temporary town that we'd be near.
And is there another Newport in Mayo?
There is indeed.
And that's where they record some of the highest temperatures, isn't it, Newport in Mayo?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is. Over the last few years, they've got, 28s, 29s, I think. Whatever their geographical situation is. It's not the Newport and County Tipperary anyway, is it?
No, it's not.
What are you up to today?
Well, I was at work. I was in school until 3 o'clock in the Convent Primary School. Hello to everybody from there. We had a lovely day. Lots of classes outside.
Great.
In the sunshine. And
now you're home.
I'm at home now.
And what class do you teach?
I teach learning support special ed, so I have groups from different classrooms.
Ah, yeah, great. Yeah. And everybody's back and everybody's happy to be back.
Absolutely delighted.
Yeah.
Much nicer to be with everyone.
Having worked with children all your life and having some children of your own, do you think that children will realise now the place that school occupies in their life a bit more?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes, I do think it's kind of brought it into reality.
Yeah,
like before, children would say, "I want to give up school for Lent," but when it became real, it wasn't as nice as they envisaged.
Of course, we know they've short memories, so if we quote them back to themselves in a few years' time, they'll probably go, "I never said that. You're crazy." Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And talking of children, can I just say a quick happy birthday to my nephew Mikey? He's 10 today.
Happy birthday, Mikey! Have a good one.
Big 10.
Okay. 5 questions each, Larry and Lorraine. Whoever answers most correctly gets the prize. If we're a draw at the end of the 5 questions, we go to a tie-break situation. Lorraine, say good luck to Larry. Larry, say good luck to Lorraine.
Good luck, Larry.
Best luck, Lorraine. Best luck.
Okay, here we go. Larry, first question for you. On this day in 1500, Pedro Alvarez Cabral became the first European to discover Brazil and claimed it for Portugal. What's the capital city of Portugal?
Lisbon.
Correct answer. I'm very self-conscious when I say Portugal because my wife says I mispronounce it. Anyway, here we go. That's out of the way. Lorraine, on this day in 1967, martial law came into effect in Greece. What's the capital city of Greece?
Athens.
Yes. Larry, second question is an audio one. Have a listen to this.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth! Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You, Lieutenant Weinberg.
Great scene. On this day, 1937, that American actor was born in New Jersey. You heard him there with Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men. Who is he?
Jack Nicholson.
Correct answer. And for you, Lorraine, have a listen to this.
What have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that wounded your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies.
On this day in 1959, that actor was divorced from actress Anna Kashfi. You heard him there in The Godfather. Can you name him?
Robert De Niro?
No. Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando. He was Robert De Niro's dad, wasn't he, in The Godfather, yeah. Okay, early days. Larry, your third question is this. On this day in 1961, there was an attempted military coup in Algeria. The flag of Algeria features one star. What colour is it? Is it red or green?
Red.
Red is the correct answer, said with confidence. Lorraine, on this day in 1981, 10,000 copper workers went on strike in Chile. The flag of Chile features one star. What colour is it? Red or white?
White.
Correct answer. Larry, your fourth question is an audio one. Have a listen to this. That song, La Isla Bonita, was number one on this day in 1987. Can you name the singer?
Madonna, I think.
Madonna, you think, is the correct answer. Yes, Madonna's right. And for you, Lorraine, have a listen to this.
Could you be the most beautiful girl in the world? Could you be slave
Now, that song, The Most Beautiful Girl in the World, was at number one on this day in 1994. Can you name the singer?
Prince.
Prince is the correct answer, yes. We lost him 5 years ago yesterday. So it's 3-4. Larry, do the maths on this. If you get this right, Lorraine can't catch you. However, if you get it wrong and Lorraine gets her final question correct, then we're into a tie-break situation. Good luck with this. On this day in 1521, French King Francois I declared war on Spain. Which of these countries has a larger population than Spain? Argentina, Canada, or Iran? So which of those countries has a larger population than Spain? Argentina, Canada, or Iran?
Oh, God. Argentina?
Argentina has 45 million. Canada, for your information, has 37 million. Spain has 46 million. So we were looking for Iran, population of 83 million. Bad news for you, good news for Lorraine. That leaves the door a bit ajar for you, Lorraine. Get this right and we're into a tie-break situation. Good luck. On this day in 1981, almost 1 million metal workers went on strike in Germany. Which of these countries has a larger population than Germany? Vietnam, the UK, or South Africa?
South Africa.
You say South Africa. South Africa has a population of 59 million. Germany has a population of 83 million.
Oh.
We were looking for Vietnam, 97 million.
Okay.
They're tricky enough, those ones. They're tricky enough. Listen, Lorraine, sorry about that. We're going to send you out a couple of Ray Darcy Show mugs.
Lovely. That's great. Thanks very much.
We're feeling generous. Lovely to talk to you. Mind yourself. Stay safe.
Bye.
See you. See you, Lorraine. Bye. Larry, it's your lucky day. Well done. Four out of five, and you're off to the Heritage when all of this is sorted. And you can go to theheritage.com to just see what's in store for you.
That's great. Thanks a million, Mary. Really appreciate it.
Good luck with the hole, and mind yourself. See you. Bye, bye, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, there are some we love, some we hate, maybe some we don't even notice. But public sculpture keeps making news headlines these days, whether it's debate about controversial figures from the past being kept up on a pedestal, or the vandalism of the aforementioned Luke Kelly's statues, or the underrepresentation of female historical figures on the Irish statue scene. Well, this Saturday is International Sculpture Day, a day to reflect on all of this. And to tell us more, I'm joined now by Professor Paula Murphy. I'll start again. Professor Paula Murphy, Professor Emeritus. See, that's it, Paul. I can't say that word. Will you say it for me? You're a former professor in UCD. Is that can
exactly?
I say?
Exactly. Yeah. Could we just use that in
yes,
a sense?
Yes,
yeah. And then you've got the School of Art History and Cultural Policy.
Yes. And the member of Sculpture Dublin.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us.
I
watched your talk from February. And I'm going to deliver a quote that you put up on a slide. A nation's life might be said to be recorded in its monuments.
Mm.
That was said by an Irish builder back in May of 1872.
Mm.
So, taking that
not our nation.
No, well, we'll start from there because when it comes to women's representation in statues and sculptures, we're not doing too well, are we?
We're not doing, let's say portrait images very
okay.
specifically, but what I'm calling real life women. We have, you know, a reasonable number of the other type, you know, from, dare I say, Molly Malone to Mother Ireland or, you know, whatever it would be. But we have a very, very, very few real life women to the point that there are. There are three of them represented in Dublin. There was once four, but Queen Victoria got taken away.
Yes.
There are three of those three figures. Countess Markievicz is commemorated in three statues.
Okay. Compared to how many portrait statues are of men?
Oh, wow, Ray, I started
hundreds.
Counting.
Hundreds, is it hundreds?
I mean, across Ireland, obviously a huge number. But I started counting in Dublin. I was sitting here kind of writing the piece and I thought, well, I'll put in a number for the men and I gave up.
Right.
I gave up around 50. I mean, if you're talking statues, I mean, just think of O'Connell Street.
Yeah.
you know, and then you walk up and you
Daniel
go
O'Connell.
To College Green, and in College Green you've got one, two, Oscar Wilde, Goldsmith, yeah. Then you've got Oscar Wilde, then you've got, oh, I mean, and in Merrion Square, not just Oscar Wilde, but all the busts of men around yes. the square, you know, I mean, they're everywhere you look.
But
men,
that's
men.
That's why I started with that quote, because that yeah. reflects how women were perceived in our country over the years. Does it not?
I think it does, of course. And yeah. I said that at the end of the article. I said, you know, an awful lot of these statues, I mean, while they're artworks and they're commemoration, they're educational. So you go and you look and you see who it is and you find out who's been commemorated and why.
Yeah.
And you don't put the ones up to them. So people will say, you know, when you mention some of the women, well, who's she? And they don't know her. Because, you know, there's no way in which she's been remembered out there.
Yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, she's not there to be seen. Yeah,
exactly. It's like a vicious circle.
It is a vicious circle. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we redress the balance then?
Well, we redress the balance by beginning to put up some of these commemorations. And, I mean, in the article I only mentioned political figures and literary, because that was what I had mentioned in relation to the men. But, you know, there are lots of other figures out there at all. I was thinking just this morning of, I don't know how it came into my head, of Siobhan McKenna.
Yeah.
You know, Siobhan McKenna, who was such a fine actress and you know, representing Ireland across the world in her acting. And you know,
Maeve Binchy.
Well, Maeve Binchy. But come back to Siobhan McKenna a moment, because
sorry.
Peggy Mike was one of her great roles. And I reckon that it would be easier to get a statue erected to Peggy and Mike than it would be to Siobhan McKenna. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And Maeve Binchy, now the Dublin City Council has a rule. This isn't across the country, because Sonia O'Sullivan is commemorated down
Cove,
in Cork.
Yeah.
Cove, yeah. Dublin City Council has a rule that the figure has to be sort of well dead. And I should know this. It should be should be in my head. It's either 10 or 20 years.
That's an odd. That's an odd rule, isn't it?
No, I don't. And Ray, I don't think so. I don't think so, because I think you know, if you put up a commemoration to somebody who's living, you've no idea how their life is going to span out.
That's fair enough. Yes, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I think the dust should settle on their fame as well, in
yeah.
a sense. You know.
Okay, so which brings us nicely on to you being a member of the Sculpture Dublin Steering Group.
Yeah.
So how does it work then, from somebody getting an idea in their heads that they want to commemorate somebody with a sculpture to it actually appearing on a street or in a square or wherever?
Okay, so yeah, so Ray, so you want to commemorate a dead Irish hero of yours. Who's your dead Irish hero?
Oh God, right. Well, let's say, I know, you know, and let's forget about that 10-year rule there. Let's say Gay Byrne. Okay.
Gay Byrne, okay,
yeah,
yes.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I think someone will get there before you, but because he's bound to be commemorated.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, Gay Byrne. If you want to put it up in the grounds of RT, you just go ahead. You do your own thing.
Yeah.
If you want that put up in College Green, for argument, you have to kind of draw up a whole plan about it. You'd make an argument for why he should be commemorated, how he should be commemorated. You might talk to sculptors about that.
But who do you make this argument to?
Well, you have to draw up this whole proposal, and it's, you know, it needs to be a pretty good one. You present it to Dublin City Council.
Okay, right.
And then they're going to discuss and debate in different groups of Dublin City Council, and then they will yay or nay to it.
And where does your steering group come in then?
The steering group that they're talking about there is, this is the difference between sort of Dublin Sculpture, which is talking about sculpture in general in Dublin. Sculpture Dublin, the reverse of that, is a project that was started by Dublin City Council last July. It was launched. And it's a 2-year project. And it's putting 6 new sculptures in place in Dublin. And it's also running a public engagement program whereby it's encouraged the lecture you're talking about. And I'm doing a series of those. And
yes.
And we're doing things to get people to engage with
okay.
public sculpture. You have to bring people to sculpture. They don't sort of automatically
and
do it.
Will these be statues of people, or will they be just generally sculptures?
they're sculptures. These are not commemorative works. Right. These are not commemorative works.
Okay. Well, we played Luke Kelly there, and yes. We mentioned him. And were they erected on the same day? Two individual.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that now?
I didn't feel good about it. No, I really didn't feel good about it. I think another male statue to begin with, but two of the same person. There shouldn't be two statues of the same person in the one city. There just shouldn't be. I mean, I'm not sure that there even should be in the country. We have that as well. There's a Liam Mellows in Galway, appropriately. And then it was decided, I can't remember, 2 or 3 years ago, that a Liam Mellows would go up in Dublin. Now, it's not in the city centre, but nonetheless, it's Dublin.
Excuse my ignorance, but who's Liam Mellows? I'm sorry.
Liam Mellows, one of those sort of fighters in you know, gaining us our freedom.
Okay,
and
right.
I'm not a historian either, right. But that's about as much as I know. But, you know, and most of these people who are being, and that I mentioned in the article, it's largely about, you know, Ireland and freedom.
Yes, okay.
And sorry, come back to the quote at the beginning that you mentioned, that you got from my lecture.
A nation's life might be said to be recorded in its monuments.
Yeah, we've no record of our past. All the monuments, pretty much all the monuments commemorating colonialism, if you like, in Ireland, were, you know, blown up or taken down or
Nelson,
whatever.
Yeah.
So the history is not there.
Okay. And how do you feel about, you know, that's the other thing we mentioned in the intro, about, you know, famous historical figures, and we're now looking at them in a different light and sort of judging them for things they did, and maybe saying that it's not appropriate that they should be up on a pedestal?
Yeah, I'm in the retain and explain camp.
Right.
You keep the work where possible, and you put up an information plaque, because that's educational too. Once you take things down, they're gone.
Yeah.
And the opportunity to inform has gone with them.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think there was a statue of a Lord Lieutenant, the Earl of Carlisle, up in the Phoenix Park. The pedestal is still there, and the name is on the pedestal. The statue was blown up in 1958. Now, I don't see why he wouldn't be there with an information plaque about, you know,
his place in our history.
Lord Lieutenant.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've about 30 seconds, Paula. So, if you were the minister for statues, commemorative statues, which is the first one you would erect?
Commemorative to a person?
Yes.
Oh, crikey. I actually don't know, because I would be more, I mean, I want those to go up. I want there to be commemorations of women, but I'd be more interested in more abstract work and really good abstract pieces in the city.
Right. Former professor at UCD, Paula Murphy. Thanks so much for talking to us today, and I'm sure we'll talk again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cormac and Sarah on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.